Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for watching. Good afternoon, Yuri. You're here with us to talk about the situation in Ukraine. But before we talk about that, maybe I would like to start with a few words about who you are. I think you were born in Ukraine in 1978. You studied there, you studied in Kyiv, and then in the US where you teach now. And you're also considered as one of the top young economists in the world. You have won many awards. Tell us a little more about you and where you come from.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Yes, I was born in 1978, many years ago, in the Soviet Union, in the part which is Ukraine now. I was born and raised in Ukraine. I did my undergraduate and master's degree at the Kyiv Mohyla Academy. It's one of the best universities in Ukraine, one of the oldest universities as well. Then I studied for 6 long years at the University of Michigan, which I loved. And then I moved to California, and I'm a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. This is my first and maybe last, maybe the only job I will ever have.
I see. And I presume you still have some family in your country, in Ukraine?
Yes, yes. I have family, friends, lots and lots of connections back to Ukraine.
And I guess it must be difficult for them at the time.
Yes, yes, it is very difficult. You know, frankly, my immediate family was under Russian occupation for about a month near Kyiv. It's a small miracle that nobody got hurt seriously, but they are safe now.
I should have mentioned also that you're one of the founders of Vox Ukraine. And for those who don't know this platform, it's I must say it's an incredible source of independent information about the country, about the economy, about the reforms that are needed, etc. So forgive me if I do a little bit of publicity here, but it's really worth it. It's on the web. It's at voxukraine.org. I highly recommend. So you're not just an economist doing your research far from the real world. You're really involved in real thing, in what's going on in your country, and your so to speak, an actor of this drama, right?
Yes, yes. So I was one of the co-founders of Vox Ukraine, and the main objective here was to bring in academic perspectives and objectivity to various political debates, independence, expertise. I've been playing various roles in Ukraine over the years. For example, now I am an advisor to the governor of the National Bank of Ukraine. I'm also advising the Minister of Economy. All of this kind of informal positions, but you know, whenever somebody calls me from Ukraine, obviously I will take that call and try to help.
One question we may have is, how do these people in these administrations or at the central bank work under the current conditions? How tough is it for them?
Well, you know, I would start by saying that when you look at economics textbooks, it's not like you have a chapter on what do you do during a war. So there is no really a playbook that you can rely on and say, well, this is what we're supposed to do under this condition. So this is what happens when missiles, you know, hit this and that. And so there is a lot of learning by doing. You experiment a lot, you try different ideas, talk to people on the ground, see, you know, what they think can work. And this is very important because in real time, as I said, you know, there is no real, you know, playbook that you can rely on. And so you have to look at other countries. You can talk to people, you know, on the ground and kind of try to come up with the best possible ideas when you have the situation.
Yes, I presume it's also difficult to have reliable data, reliable statistics on the state of the economy.
Absolutely. You know, this is one of the things which makes decision making even harder, because you have the fog of war. You know, for example, the unemployment data has not been formally collected since the beginning of the war because it's based on surveying people. And, you know, some people don't want to say where they are for security reasons. Many people left the country. And so even formally they appear on Ukrainian, you know, say employment rolls. It doesn't mean they're actually, they can be anywhere.
So, for example, do we have an idea of the unemployment rate, or does it have, is it meaningful?
Well, so this is where you have to be creative and try to rely on indirect measures. For example, one measure of economic activity, which you know historically is correlated with kind of broader health of the economy, is the number of tickets sold by the national railroad company. So if that number is very low, economy is not doing very well. If that number is high, the number of tickets of sold is high, it means the economy is doing very well. And that data is actually, you know, available, and you can, you know, have some indirect inference about what is happening in the economy. For example, you know, usually statistical agencies rely on sending agents to various stores to collect prices. Now it's not safe. You cannot do this everywhere. But we know we can rely on prices for goods sold online. Okay. And so this is much faster to collect, much safer to collect. And so, for example, the National Bank of Ukraine is using this data as an early indicator of what is happening to the economy and have an independent source of information to see, you know, what is happening, where we have problems, where we have bottlenecks, where the economy is heading. So a lot of creativity.
Yeah. So we have an idea for example on the inflation rate at the moment, do we?
Yes. Yeah. You know, I think we have for inflation specifically, precisely because of this, you know, creative solutions and other independent sources of information. We know inflation was very high in Ukraine at the beginning of the war. It was close to 25%, but now it has been declining consistently over many months now. It's in single digits. It's going to be probably 7% by the end of the year. And, you know, for a country that is in a war with Russia, it's really remarkable that inflation is so much under control.
So before talking about the reconstruction of Ukraine, and we'll get into that in a few minutes, but it's probably relevant to look at where we're coming from. And could you maybe tell us or describe to us the main features of the economy before the war? How would you characterize the economy of Ukraine at the time? How strong was it? How connected was it to the world economy or to the EU? What were the challenges before the war, just to give us a picture of where we're coming from?
Yes, let me give you sort of a brief historical excursion into, you know, what was happening with the Ukrainian economy. You know, formally Ukraine became independent in 1991, and at that time we didn't have private property, we didn't have markets, so it was a big wave of privatization, liberalization, and so on. And in the early 90s, Ukraine had one of the biggest economic contractions on record. GDP declined by something 60%. Then after that initial collapse, economic collapse, which was very, very bad, you had a stage of recovery. So for about, you know, 10 years, the economy was growing very fast. Then you have the global financial crisis, which hit Ukraine very hard because Ukraine relied a lot on commodities like metals, agricultural products, and so on. When prices for all these goods collapsed, demand collapsed, Ukrainian economy contracted quite a bit. Then after the global financial crisis, there was a recovery stage again. It was, I wouldn't say very strong, but there was, you know, some recovery. And unfortunately, in 2014, when the Russians had the first sort of round of aggression, when they annexed Crimea and when they occupied parts of the Donbas, this is when we had another massive crisis. We had a currency crisis, a banking crisis, because so much productive capacity was either occupied by the Russians, or if it was, for example, Ukrainian banks would issue loans to firms in Crimea, and suddenly these loans are non-performing. So it was a big crisis there. And after that crisis in 2014-15, there was again a round of recovery. But the main challenge for that recovery was that there was a heavy weight of security concerns. You know, in the eyes of many investors, Ukraine was not a very attractive place because nobody yeah. was sure if Russia is going to attack again or if, you know, what is going to happen in the long term with the country. And so despite this recovery, you know, it wasn't as strong as many people would like it to have. But you also see that there was a huge change in the composition of what Ukraine was doing. For example, Ukraine before 2014 traded a lot with Russia. Not anymore. A lot of trade was redirected to the European Union, to other countries. Yeah. And so since roughly 2014-15, the trade linkages got, you know, fairly minimal. You also see that there was a change in the industrial structure of the country. For yeah. example, many people don't know that the number one export from Ukraine to the United States is not agricultural, it's not steel, it is IT services. Right. So this IT services is really something amazing. I keep saying that, you know, I'm in California, Silicon Valley, yeah. and, you know, people describe this as Wild West. But in Ukraine, you have something similar, except it's going to be Wild East, that you have this, you know, amazing ecosystem of IT engineers who come up with ideas, you know, they're bubbling with various projects. And, you know, even during the war.
So they work from Ukraine for American companies in California. That's what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and, you know, even during the war, this sector was growing double digits, which is amazing. When you don't have electricity, when you don't have, you know, all sorts of things, but you can still grow very, very fast. It was incredible.
So that's interesting. Before the war, just before the war, the Ukraine was not so much dependent on Russia for its economy. It was much more directed to the West.
You know, ironically, for example, Ukraine did not really depend on Russian gas.
Yeah. Mm.
So it was either internal sources or imports from other places. And kind of shockingly, it turned out that many European countries are much more dependent on Russian gas than Ukraine.
You mentioned investors, and I remember talking to international investors again before the war. And one of the things that came up all the time was that they were worried about the level of corruption. So could you tell us a little bit about that and how it's, I mean, is it still a major concern today?
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad it came on the, 15th minute of our interview instead of 22nd. Because, you know, usually this is number one question. What happens with corruption in Ukraine?
But is it the number one problem? Probably not because of the war, but is it still a number one problem in the economic field?
Yes. Yeah. You know, I would say, you know, objectively, you know, it's a reputation that needs to be addressed. And so there is no question about that. There is also a very wide perception in Ukraine that this is a very important issue, basically number one after the Russian aggression. And so something has to be done. You know, I should say that, you know, we kind of had cycles in terms of what was happening with corruption in Ukraine. For example, you go to 2013 or so when Viktor Yanukovych was president of the country, and that was a really low point because he was stealing and his cronies stealing left and right. So that was a really bad time. And if you look at various metrics of corruption, you see that over time, since 2014, Ukraine has been doing, you know, very significant progress in terms of addressing this. For example, public officials in Ukraine are required to disclose not only their incomes, but also their spending. And not just them personally, but also their family members. For example, your in-laws, your children, your parents, all of these people have to show their incomes and spending. And so this has a huge preventive role for corruption.
This is something that was implemented under the current administration, or?
This was done earlier, 2000, 15, 16, then was put on pause, and then now it's reinstated as one of the conditions for starting negotiations with the European Union. You know, the main issue there was that it provided so much information that some people felt that it's not a good idea to disclose so much during the war. So, you know, we can kind of debate about what can be disclosed and what cannot be disclosed during the war. But this would be one example of how Ukraine is fighting corruption. There is also a lot more transparency. All government contracts have to go through a central procurement system. Anybody can basically go to a website and see who got what were the terms of various contracts. And so there is a lot more transparency. And you know, probably most importantly, when you look at various polls and people are asked, do you think corruption is justified under some circumstances? There is a huge change in public perceptions about, you know, what is acceptable and what is not. If before people were saying, sure, you know, you can sometimes justify corruption. Now the vast majority of people say, no, it is not justified under any circumstances. And so we see that Ukraine is shifting this, you know, corrupt equilibrium from this corrupt equilibrium to something which is much less tolerant to corruption. And so this gives me hope that, you know, something is going to change in Ukraine fairly quickly.
So this this culture of corruption, so to speak, is gradually disappearing. That's what you're saying.
Yes, and also, you know, when you look at various victimization surveys, when people are asked, you know, do you think you have corruption in the country? Many people will say, yeah, we have corruption in the country. But on the other hand, when you ask the same people, do you personally, you know, give bribes or anything like this? And the vast majority of people say, no, we're not doing any of that. So this is saying that, you know, reputation has still some, you know, weight on what people are thinking about the country. But the objective data appears to suggest that Ukraine is actively moving away from this, you know, corrupt equilibrium.
So there's still a lot of work to do to convince international investors that things are changing. But actually,
yes, you know, unfortunately, what's in with corruption, you know, nobody can defeat it, you know, 100%. So it's always there in one form or another. But, you know, at least in Ukraine, there is a clear perception that this is a threat to basically the livelihood of the whole country. It's a threat to national security. So it has to be addressed now decisively.
So, under your leadership, the Center for Economic Policy Research, which is based in Europe, has launched what is called a Ukraine Initiative, I believe, and to study the ways to rebuild your country's economy. Could you tell us a little bit about your work and what you see that is needed to rebuild the economy?
Yeah, so first of all, I want to thank my European friends and colleagues for supporting this initiative, because no single person can pull off something like this. It's lots and lots of people who contribute to this effort. That's number one. Number two, I often get the question about why we should start thinking about this now when the war is still raging and it's not clear when it's going to be over. And, you know, the usual answer I give for these questions is that when you look at, say, for example, World War II, reconstruction after World War II, the Marshall Plan arrived to Europe in 1948. But the war, the victory day in Europe, was in 1945. It was very difficult 3 years in Europe before this aid hit the ground in France, in Italy, in the United Kingdom, in Germany, and many other countries. And we should learn from that, I would say, mistake, that we shouldn't wait 3 years until politicians, planners, everybody agrees, and then we have a plan. We have to start thinking now, because when we have the first day of peace, we should be ready to unleash, you know, significant resources into reconstruction. And also, you know, I want to be very clear that this reconstruction is not just about rebuilding bridges the way they were before. It's really about the modernization of the country. And some of these elements of modernization, they don't really require you know, significant steps. For example, we talked about corruption. You can reform your country to deal with corruption without investments from France or from Germany or from any other country, right? So you can pass laws, you can change regulations, you can introduce new institutions. You can do this during the war, maybe especially during the war, to make sure that you have the best use of available resources.
We're almost after the war started 2 years ago almost. And what's your assessment on the impact of the war so far in terms of economic destruction? Could we put a number on that? It's if it makes sense.
You know, one challenge here is that it's really impossible to quantify the human suffering in Ukraine because so many people died, so many people left the country. But when you look at economic indicators, you see a clear picture of devastation. You know, various estimates suggest that you know, GDP declined by 30%. So, you know, a third of the economy is basically destroyed. You have millions of people who left the country. You have millions of people who are internally displaced. You see that a lot of energy infrastructure is destroyed by the Russians. Bridges, schools, hospitals. You know, estimates from various sources suggest that the damages may be anywhere between $400 billion and $1 trillion, right? So, and this is, you know, without knowing what is happening in the lands which are now currently occupied by the Russians, we have no way of knowing what is happening there. So if you want to have kind of a rule of thumb estimate for the destruction, you know, every day of the war costs Ukraine roughly $1 billion, maybe $1.5 billion. So every day of this war is extremely expensive.
And of course, you mentioned it, but on top of that, you have the human impact, the social impact of the war, which is, of course, difficult to quantify, but it's obviously enormous because you lost a lot of young people in this war. How do you, what can we say about that on the impact it will have, the long-term impact of the war on this ground?
Yeah, so, you know, some people basically killed in the war, and that's a very direct loss. Unfortunately, nobody knows for sure the hard numbers on this in Ukraine. But even if you look at other elements of this tragedy, for example, you have children who first had COVID, they didn't have proper education for, you know, a year, year and a half. Yeah. Now, as you said, the war is almost for 2 years. Again, unless you have a bomb shelter in the school, you can't have proper education in that area. And so now we have a whole generation of Ukrainian kids who didn't have proper education. You know, they lost 2, 3, you know, maybe even 4 years of education. And recovering from this scar is going to be very, very difficult. So you will have to invest significant resources to have extra teaching, extra counselors, you know, maybe a summer semesters, exchange programs. You know, you have to catch up somehow. But this is going to take a long time because we know education takes time. There is only a window of opportunity in some ages. And so if you don't have, you know, proper instruction when kids are young, we know this is going to have a highly, highly persistent effect on their human capital, on their careers, on their earnings, on everything.
So you worked on this issue of rebuilding the economy, not just reconstruction, as you mentioned, not just the reconstruction of roads or bridges, but really revamp the economy. So what would be the main features of this plan?
You know, this is such a monumental task that it's not just, you know, one feature or two features. It's really, you know, many, many things have to work together. For example, I mentioned that, you know, when we think about reconstruction, we have to have clear end goals. What do we want to have in the end? And I mentioned that modernization of the country is the goal. Right. So it means if we rebuild something in Ukraine, it has to be a modern thing. For example, we have lots of Ukrainian cities destroyed. The housing stock in those places was basically coming from the Soviet times, which means these buildings are not very energy efficient. They're not particularly friendly for building local communities. So we don't need to restore these buildings the way they were before the war. We need to have more livable places. We need to have more energy efficient buildings. So that will be kind of one principle. It's all about modernization. Another thing which is very clear from what we saw in other countries in various reconstruction efforts in different times is that Ukraine has to have ownership in this process because, you know, it's easy to rebuild the bridge somewhere, but at some point the aid is going to be withdrawn and it's going to be the local community that is going to take care of the school or the bridge or whatever was constructed with you know, donors or, you know, whoever is going to sponsor this. And so the idea here is that, you know, if we want to rebuild, say, you know, a school or a bridge in Bucha, it has to happen because the local community really needs it. Because at some point they're going to have to take care of this and they will take care of this only if they value this. Another principle is that, you know, we have to have a lot of coordination. We already see that lots and lots of countries, organizations, people want to help Ukraine. And we want to make sure that we utilize these resources, this goodwill, to the best possible degree. And this means we want to avoid duplication of efforts. We want to have clear information sharing. And so this calls for establishing some type of agency that is going to aggregate information, allow people to negotiate, come up with plans, share their experiences, kind of see what is the best practice, this kind of sense. We also say in various reports that, you know, when the country is so much destroyed by the war, giving loans to Ukraine to reconstruct is not really a good strategy because Ukraine will not be able to repay these loans for, you know, foreseeable future. And we also know from the experience of, for example, the Marshall Plan, that giving grants is much more effective because you inject resources, you don't settle countries with debt. This is really paving the road to much more economic progress. Also, the integration of the of Ukraine with the European Union, that's kind of the guiding star for lots and lots of things that are going to happen in Ukraine. We want to align institutions with the European Union. We want to make sure we have the same market. This is going to be a huge boost. We saw that Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, and so on, they hugely benefited from this.
But this is more a medium to long-term thing, isn't it?
Yes, it's true. But, you know, we should see that, for example, when there was a prospect of joining the European Union for Poland, investments started before Poland formally joined the European Union. We see big productivity gains, entry of foreign investments. We see, you know, new production facilities. So something like this is also going to happen in Ukraine. And, you know, perhaps, you know, most, you know, challenging part is going to be security. We want to make sure that Ukraine is not going to be attacked by the Russians again anytime soon, because, you know, if there is a significant probability that you build a factory somewhere in Ukraine and it may be destroyed with Russian missiles, you know, next week or next month, nobody is going to invest in Ukraine. So we have to have ironclad security guarantees that another round of aggression just can't happen.
That's probably also an issue for the future for your country, because I suppose that in the future, given the threat of Russia, which is it's quite likely that a big chunk of Ukraine's budget will have to be devoted to the military. And so it will absorb a lot of resources just to defend yourself, no?
Yes, that's true. You know, what we see now in Ukraine, obviously, is that, you know, we have this saying in Ukraine that solving your problems is your problem. And so, you know, to some extent, the defense of Ukraine is our own problem, right? It's only our Ukrainian soldiers who are fighting in this war. Lots of equipment is from Ukraine. Obviously, we have an enormous amount of help from our allies, but a lot of hard fighting is done by Ukraine. And so it's very clear that even in the future, when Ukraine may be part of some union, the number one sort of defense line is going to be Ukraine's own resources. And, you know, for example, before the full-scale invasion, Ukraine was committing 5% of GDP to the security sector. It's roughly comparable to how much, for example, Israel or Korea is spending.
Yes.
And this is going to be, you know, an issue for many years to come. And this is, again, the reason why we have to have a strong economy, because to support these huge defense budgets, you have to have a strong economy. Mm. And so it's not just, you know, we need to have better and more military equipment and soldiers. It's also we have to have means to pay for it.
You mentioned the financing of all this. You mentioned loans. It's not the most efficient way of doing, as you said. You mentioned grants. How confident are you that you will get the enough resources to revamp the economy? You mentioned the huge cost of the destructions in almost $1 trillion dollars. So where will the money come from, and how confident are you that you will get enough money? What are the savings of your...
It's a really $1 trillion. Yes, it's a really $1 trillion question. You know, I would say this. First of all, you know, suppose it's going to be $1 trillion.
Yeah.
First of all, it's not going to be a lump sum payment now. This is going to be a sum of money that is going to be spread out over the years. So if our horizon is about 10 years, it means we're going to have $100 billion, you know, roughly every year. It's still a lot of money. Now, having said this, in the early phases of reconstruction, I'm pretty sure that a lot of aid has to come from public funds, because very few people, businesses, will be willing to invest in Ukraine at that stage. You still have a lot of uncertainty. You have to do a lot of demining, you know, cleanups and so on. This is not good for private businesses. But after this initial stage is completed, then the second stage, when we have kind of more security, you know, done, and people are confident that they can operate safely in the country, this is the time when private money should come in.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think it's a good sign, because ultimately what is going to create a strong, sustainable economy in Ukraine is not public money necessarily. We have to integrate Ukraine into global value chains, into, you know, all sorts of, you know, production linkages. And this is going to be done only with private money. So we want to have Peugeot or Renault come to Ukraine. We want to have BMW to come to Ukraine. We want to have Airbus to come to Ukraine. We want to have all this, you know, foreign investors to come in Ukraine and use, you know, unique opportunities that Ukraine can offer. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's going to be private money, then it's clear that it's not necessarily taxing people in France or Germany or somewhere else. There is also a question of Russian money. You know, we know that huge sums of Russian money is frozen in various places. In my view, it would be only fair if this money is used to pay for reconstruction and compensation, because, you know, there has to be some, you know, fairness in all of this. Why would French taxpayers, you know, contribute some money to the reconstruction of Ukraine while the Russian government doesn't pay a cent for it? I don't think it would be fair. Now, how this will happen with Russian money, I don't know, but I think if there is a will, there is a way.
Do we have an estimate on this amount of Russian money that is frozen at the moment?
Yes, it's about 300 billion euros.
Mm. So
very
that's
significant.
Quite significant, yeah.
It's very significant.
One of the things that are needed probably also is to revamp the economy is to the questions of regarding the institutions, governance, rule of law, things like that. do you see, how do you see the reforms that are needed in this field? How would you, could you just describe to us what kind of reforms are needed to just to maintain confidence from overseas?
You know, the rule of law is a very important concept, but it's very hard to make it all work. You know, many countries have tried to do this to, you know, various degrees of success. For Ukraine, it's a big must. You know, you hear from investors, from regular people that, you know, there is this issue with the protection of property rights, the rule of law more generally. And I would say, you know, there are several elements which are going to be important here. One is Ukraine still has a lot of Soviet legacy. For example, lots and lots of economic and political decisions are highly centralized. So basically somebody from Kyiv making all sorts of decisions. And this is not good for democracy. It's not good for fighting corruption. It's not good for protection of property rights. We need to decentralize. Right, so we need to have more power given to local councils, to local governments, to cities, so they decide for themselves what is going to be good or not good for them. And we know from theory, from experience, that when you have more political competition, it's going to put more checks and balances on the authorities, and so this is going to be good for the economy and the rule of law. That's number one. Number two, there is a wide perception in Ukraine, at least, that the judicial branch is sort of lagging in the reforms remains sort of a major roadblock for establishing a rule of law. And again, this is a combination of, you know, Soviet legacy and unreformed agenda. For example, in 2014-15, there was a plan to kind of reboot the judicial branch of the government. It was not done, unfortunately, and this still remains an issue. So we need to have a better system of courts, a more transparent process for appointing judges. We need to have a separation between the judicial branch and other branches of the government to make sure that, you know, elements of corruption are less likely to happen with judges. So this is probably going to take a while. This is the longest, I think.
Yeah, it takes time. This is not something so easy to do. It's a whole culture that you need to change.
Exactly. And this is why we have to start doing this now. We don't have to wait until the war is over. And for example, you have some you know, positive developments. We have a higher anti-corruption court, which was very effective in giving real sentences to, you know, high-ranking officials taking bribes or engaging in other forms of corruption. So it can work. Okay. But this is still unfinished agenda, I believe.
When you look at the future and you, when you imagine the your economy in a few years, what would be the competitive advantages of Ukraine, you think?
You know, I would say that to say past is the best predictor of the future. And so for Ukraine, you know, agricultural business is still going to be highly, highly competitive. And
so it probably will still be a very strong of your economy.
Yes, we see also that, you know, some of the heavy industry like metals and so on, there are lots and lots of fundamentals for why this industry should be successful. We also see that IT sector is going to grow faster and faster and faster. There is more college graduates in this sector, so there is supply of talent there. There is more demand to develop this sector. So this is going to be important. I would say this would be like the three kind of obvious channels that, you know, we inherit from the past. But also, kind of ironically, Ukraine now is a forefront of developing new military technologies. And one can imagine that Ukraine is going to be a major force in the defense industry.
You live in the US. When we look at the US, there's a big question mark, of course, next year's election. And if there's a change in the administration, which is possible, Are you concerned that there could be that the level of help that you get from the US could diminish, and that the US may be less concerned by financing a possible recovery of Ukraine if there's peace in the near future?
Well, obviously, Ukraine depends on the allies for economic and military support. But, you know, having said this, I don't think, you know, if U.S. stop, you know, supporting Ukraine, the war is going to be over. It just will change the character of the war. Ukraine will continue fighting. That's number one. Number two, even if we have somebody in the White House who is less predictable, you know, kind of... God works in mysterious ways. Who knows what is going to happen? You know, for example, when that person was in the office before, this was the first time when Ukraine received lethal weapons from the U.S. government. For example, the Obama administration sent to Ukraine only blankets and helmets, no lethal weapons. Well, you know, the successor sent you know, actual weapons to Ukraine. So. For me, it's very hard to predict what will happen.
No, of course. And regarding the European Union, I mean, if you had a message to the Europeans, what would it be? I mean, do you think that the European Union is doing enough, that they understand well what the needs are, or are we still... in this state of war, and we're not thinking enough of the future? What would be your messages to the EU on that?
You know, I would say that the main challenge here is not really the level of support, even though it can be bigger. I think the main challenge is that the public in the European Union does not understand the mortal danger we have in this war. If Russia defeats Ukraine, Russia is not going to stop in Ukraine. The war will come to every doorstep in France, in Germany, in Poland. I have a feeling that in Europe, people don't have the same sense of urgency that, you know, this is, you know, very, very dangerous. And we have to mobilize our resources and try to resolve this issue as quickly as possible, because this cancer of war will spread far beyond Ukraine. And so we have to deal with this issue decisively now, because if we don't solve this problem now, then everybody will be affected by this war. And so I wish there were more sense of urgency and understanding that this is really an existential threat, not only for Ukraine, but for democracy and the European Union specifically.
Okay, well, that's very clear. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Nicola. Thank you.
We hope we have peace in the near future.
I hope so too.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.